We're getting back into the survey of the Old Testament, and I thought about talking about the prophets sort of in a chronological order, but the problem is that there's a lot of overlap, and I was afraid I might confuse you even more by doing it chronologically than just going by the way they are in the Bible. So we'll go ahead and start talking about the prophet Isaiah. But before we talk about the prophet Isaiah, let's talk a little bit about what a prophet in the Old Testament was. Can anyone give me a quick definition of what they think a prophet was in the Old Testament? Someone who foretells the future. Anything else?
Messenger from God.
Okay. The answer most people would give is someone who tells the future, and that's certainly part of what prophets did, but that's actually not even what most of what they had to say was about. A prophet was not just a foreteller, but they were also a forth-teller. They talked about what God had to say about what people were doing and what they needed to be doing differently than they were doing. But they, in the context of talking about those things, they would also talk about what God was going to do. And so we have a number of prophets that are in the historical books that never wrote anything. The prophet Elijah, we don't have any book that was written by the prophet Elijah. We don't have any book that was written by the prophet Elisha, and yet these are two of the greatest of the prophets of the Old Testament. But at a certain point, the prophets started to write books. And why that happened, who knows? Maybe one of them started to do it, and then the other prophets thought, well, that's a good way to record what we're saying so that future generations will be able to benefit from this. But in the Bible, you have two collections of the prophets. You have the major prophets, and you have the minor prophets. And they're categorized not by their importance, but rather by the size of the books that they wrote. So there are 12 minor prophets, but they're called minor prophets because their books are relatively short. Some of them are as short as one chapter. A few of them, you know, maybe, you know, 10, 11 chapters, but most of them are a few chapters apiece. The prophet Isaiah is 66 chapters, and so it's the largest of the prophetic books. And one thing interesting about the prophecy of Isaiah is that of all the books that Christ quotes from, at least as we can tell from the Gospels, there are three books he quoted from the most, and Isaiah is one of them. He's number three. The first one that he quoted from the very most was the Psalms, more than any other book of the Bible. And then the one after that was the book of Deuteronomy. And then the prophecy of Isaiah was number three, and then the book of Exodus was number four. And after that, the number of quotations are so small that it'd be hard to categorize them, because probably Genesis would be number five, would be my guess. The prophet Isaiah lived from approximately, or I should say he prophesied from around the year 740 BC to sometime in the reign of King Manasseh, who began his reign in 687 BC. Keep in mind, when you're counting BC years, they go in the reverse of what our years go now. And he prophesied for a very long time during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And then according to tradition, he was actually martyred during the reign of Manasseh. Manasseh was a very wicked king, although he repented at the end of his life, and we have his prayer of repentance in the Orthodox Bible. But he engaged in child sacrifice, and he persecuted the prophets, and according to tradition, he had Isaiah sawed in half. So in Hebrews chapter 11, when it talks about people being sawn in half, that's who he's referring to, according to the tradition of the church. His name means the Lord of Salvation. And the fathers comment on the prophecy of Isaiah probably more than any other prophet. You find a lot of patristic commentary on him, and a lot of the fathers have spoke of him as being, in a very high way sense, I can't remember which father it was, but there was one father I ran across that said that the prophet Isaiah was more of a gospel writer than he was a prophet, and that's because so much of what he writes about is quoted in the Gospels, but it's also he foretells so much about Christ that it is like another gospel. Now, the prophecy of Isaiah, if you're talking about the two big sections, The first section is chapters 1 through 39. And then the second section is chapters 40 through 66. And if you listen to liberal scholars, it's very common for them to say that the second half of Isaiah was written by someone long after the time of Isaiah the prophet, someone after the exile or during the exile. And so they talk about second Isaiah. So there are some scholars that even talk about a third Isaiah and a fourth Isaiah. And when I was a college student, I did a spoof church periodical, and in one of the articles in that article was an interview with Second Isaiah, and it was all about how his group, the Isaiahs, had broken up, and it was sort of modeled on the Beatles. And he had tried his hand with other groups like the Jeremiahs, but it just really didn't work. But the reason why they postulate more than one Isaiah is because if you start off with the a priori assumption that prophecy doesn't exist, that there is no God, that there's no way that a prophet could know the future, you would have to say that someone wrote all this stuff after the time of Isaiah because there's so much that he foretells. But that's just simply because they're starting at it from a skeptical standpoint. It's not because there's anything in the text that would say, hey, here's another writer. As a matter of fact, one of the oldest biblical manuscripts we have came from the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's called the Isaiah Scroll, and it's dated usually at about 150 BC as the copy, and that text is in Hebrew, and it's almost identical to the Hebrew text as we have it today, although there are some places where it more closely matches the Septuagint. But what you don't find is chapters 1 through 39 as a separate book someplace. If you found something like that, then at least you'd have a little bit more of an argument that maybe there was an earlier proto-Isaiah and then a second Isaiah, but there's no textual evidence, just pure skeptical speculation. But if we talk about the first section, chapters 1 through 39, it's much more focused on God's judgment. The first 12 chapters focuses on God's judgment of Jerusalem. The first 5 chapters, there's a whole series of prophecies about the wickedness of the people of Jerusalem. And then in chapter 6, there's a very important chapter, which you've heard me reference on a number of occasions, and you hear it referred to very often in the services of the church. And this is the vision that Isaiah had in the year that King Uzziah died. And to understand why he would make a reference like that, King Uzziah was not the most pious king, but he had a very long reign. And Judah experienced a great deal of prosperity and peace during his reign. I think he reigned more than 50 years. I should have wrote down that number. But he reigned so long that in those days, given how long most people lived, there were many people who were born and died before, you know, and that was the only king that they ever knew. And so when you have something like that, it'd be kind of like if you imagine if you were an Englishman and you'd been born during the reign of Queen Elizabeth. When she dies, that's going to be a pretty significant occasion because you've only known one queen all of your life, and then all of a sudden you're going to be stuck with Prince Charles as your king, and it's going to be quite a letdown. Well, he had this vision of God in the temple, and in this vision he was struck by his own sinfulness, even though there's no reason to indicate that he had lived especially a moral life up to that point. But in the presence of a holy God, he nevertheless recognized that he was a sinner, and he wasn't worthy to stand in God's presence. And in that vision, an angel takes a coal from the altar with a tong, and he touches it to his lips. And the angel says, "Behold, this has touched thy lips, and taketh away thine iniquity, and purgeth away thy sins." This, the fathers say, was sort of a foreshadowing of the Eucharist, as because when you receive communion, the priest says that it's unto the remission of sins, right? So he was cleansed by this coal from the altar, and then he was commissioned to go and to preach. And God foretold to him that he was going to preach, but people weren't going to listen. People would be hearing, but they wouldn't be listening. But that basically what he was going to be saying would be mostly heard by a future generation. And so this gets back to all the liberal scholars that want to say that someone else wrote all the stuff that's prophetic. The whole book is written with the assumption that this generation that Isaiah was living with were not really going to pay much attention to what he had to say. It was only going to be the next generation that would really fully hear him, although there were some kings that listened to him to a large extent, Hezekiah being the best example. And so then, starting with chapter 7 through chapter 12, Isaiah prophesies the downfall of King Ahaz, but in the context of that prophecy, what does he talk about? That's where the virgin shall be with child, and shall bring forth a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel. Chapter 9, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. So he's basically saying, you're a loser, King Ahaz. You had your chance, because he said, you know, if you'll stop trusting in these other kingdoms and just trust God, God will deliver you. And Ahaz piously says, well, you know, he said, ask any sign, and I'll give it to you to prove that God is going to do what I'm saying. And he says, well, I wouldn't dare ask God for a sign. And Isaiah knew that wasn't because he was really being pious. It was because he didn't want to really obey. And so that's when Isaiah starts to prophesy about this coming Messiah that would be of the line of David, but would be the real seed of David. And then chapters 13 through 27, there's a whole series of prophecies about God's judgment on the nations, particularly Babylon. And again, Babylon wasn't really the kingdom that was the most immediate threat to Judah at that time. So the fact that he spent so much time talking about Babylon in this first section, that's supposedly by first Isaiah, already shows that this is talking about the future. But he does talk about Assyria and some of the other kingdoms and how they'll be destroyed. And he prophesies also that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed, but that there was a new Jerusalem that was to come. As a matter of fact, in the Zadostoinic, or the ninth ode for the Apostle Canon, what's the line that we all hear during the liturgy when that's sung? Shine, shine, O New Jerusalem, for the glory of the Lord has risen upon thee. That's almost word for word out of Isaiah, except he didn't use the word New Jerusalem in Isaiah, but he said, shine, shine, O Jerusalem, for the glory of the Lord has risen upon thee. But he's foretelling this coming day when basically New Jerusalem would come. And what is New Jerusalem? I just wrote an article about this week, but the New Jerusalem is really talking about the church. It's talking about the church in heaven in some passages of Scripture, but it's talking about the church that was to come, the church of the nations. And then chapters 28 through 39, Isaiah accuses the leaders of Judah for placing false hopes and alliances rather than trusting in God, because they kept, for example, thinking that if they just made an alliance with Egypt, Egypt would save them. And I'm not sure if Isaiah is the one that uses this phrase, but other prophets talked about the same thing, and one of them talked about how you're leaning on the broken reed of the Egyptians. In other words, if you lean on a reed, what's going to happen is that reed is going to stick you in your hand, but also it's not a very firm thing to lean on, because Egypt, even though it was a very ancient kingdom and had a great power at one time, it wasn't the power that it used to be, and it got taken over by the Assyrians first, and then later by the Babylonians, and then after them by the Greeks, and after them by the Romans. So they were one of the most conquered nations in the world. So depending on them to save you was a pretty stupid thing for them to do. And then Isaiah prophesies to Hezekiah that God will deliver Jerusalem. And this is one of the prophecies that we have verification in the historical record that it happened exactly the way that Isaiah said, because Assyria had wiped out the northern kingdom of Israel by this time, and it was trying to do the same thing with Judah, and it captured quite a few of their cities, and they laid siege to Jerusalem. And we have, although these records, many of them may be destroyed by ISIS, unfortunately, but you have an incredible amount of records in Iraq and Syria from the, well, I guess it would mostly be in Iraq, because that's where Nineveh is. The city of Mosul is the ancient city of Nineveh. And there was a record from Sennacherib of his laying siege to Jerusalem. He talked about how he had Hezekiah caged like a bird, but he didn't boast about actually capturing Hezekiah, and he had to leave. And the according to the Bible, he had to leave because, number one, there was a plague in his army, and number two, I think one of his sons was rebelling against him back in Nineveh, so he had to pull up stakes from outside of Jerusalem and depart, not having captured the city of Jerusalem. And so it was delivered as God had promised, and as Hezekiah had trusted. And this last section, chapters 36 through 39, is all historical narrative. It's not just prophetic oracles, but it's actually just describing what happened, this great miracle that happened. But then in chapter 39, after Hezekiah, who had trusted in God, was one of the better kings of Judah, what did he do? He started trying to make an alliance with the Babylonians because he thought, well, just in case the Assyrians come back, let me start trying to have good relations with the Babylonians. And so he takes these Babylonian ambassadors and he says, you know, take a look at my palace, take a look at the temple, this, all these great and wonderful things. And Isaiah told him, you know, that was pretty stupid because these are the people that are going to come and to steal all the goods and destroy this city. And in about 100 years, that's exactly what happened. Well, a little bit more than 100 years, I think. But chapters 40 through 66 are the ones that are more focused on the future, and there's more of a focus on hope, although it's interspersed with prophecies of judgment as well. But chapter 40 begins with the words, "Comfort ye my people." And it talks about the voice crying in the wilderness, which is a prophecy of St. John the Baptist. And so these prophecies gave comfort to the Jews when they were in exile and also when they returned from exile, but they were also pointing towards this coming of the Messiah. And then in chapter, beginning with chapter 49 through 55, you have a whole series of prophecies about the suffering servant. So throughout the Old Testament, you have all kinds of prophecies of the Messiah, but more often than not, the Messiah is depicted as a powerful God-anointed ruler who would bring peace. But in these chapters, we see the Messiah predicted not as a great comforter, but as someone who would be despised and rejected and who would suffer. And some of the descriptions of what Christ would endure are so vivid and so close to what you find in the Gospels. That's why the Father I mentioned talks about this as one of the other, as another Gospel. And then in chapters 56 through 66, he focuses on the coming kingdom, both the judgment that God would give to the wicked, but also the, you know, the everlasting kingdom of peace that would come to those that believe. Any questions about that?
So the suffering servant prophecies, were those recognized for, you know, the time of Christ by the Jewish people as prophecies?
Well, as a matter of fact, that Isaiah scroll that I mentioned from the Dead Sea Scrolls, they date it to about 150 B.C. And so there's no question that that text existed as we have it long before Christ. And so it's one of those prophecies that you can't say was written after the fact to try to match what happened.
But did they recognize it as referring to the future Messiah?
I'm not sure that they did. There's the story in the book of Acts about the Ethiopian eunuch, and of course he wasn't a Jewish, he might have been a convert to Judaism, but he was not one of the Jewish rabbis, but he had no idea what he was reading until it was explained to him by the Apostle Philip. And I suspect a lot of Jews didn't quite know what to make of that. What Jews now will say is that those prophecies were prophecies of the suffering of the people of Israel. But the problem is that those prophecies talk about this servant being despised and rejected by his own people, and so it wouldn't make sense for this prophecy to be talking about the people of Israel who also despised and rejected themselves. That just doesn't make any sense. Any other questions?
How would you suggest reading through Isaiah? Just start at the beginning, go through, or pick certain sections?
Well, I think it's good to read it straight through. Now, what I would say is it's good to have a good study Bible, or there's a program you can download. I have a blog post on this subject, but it's called eSword, and I recommend a bunch of old public domain commentaries. But the reason why something like that is helpful is he does make a lot of references to kings and to nations and stuff like that. And if you don't understand the historical context of what he's talking about, it's often hard to understand. As a matter of fact, I think that the lack of understanding the historical context is one of the reasons why so many Protestants will read a prophet like Isaiah talking about the return of the exiles after the Babylonian captivity, and they read that as God predicting that the Israelis would take Israel back and displace the Palestinians, and that God's on the side of Netanyahu and all this kind of stuff. And that's not what these prophecies are talking about. They're talking about a return from exile that happened, in the Old Testament. It happened in the 5th century B.C. or the 4th century B.C., somewhere around in there. And so it'd be early or late. These are in reverse. Late 5th century B.C. So if you don't understand these things, and particularly if you do like Hal Lindsey and you got your newspaper out, you can misunderstand a lot of these prophecies, because all these prophecies that you find, even though they were future when Isaiah wrote them, they're not future now. Most of those prophecies have been fulfilled. Yeah.
You wonder if John probably borrowed from Isaiah, kind of.
Well, the book of Revelation uses a lot of symbolism from other prophecies. There's no question about it. And that's one of the reasons why some Protestants will read the book of Revelation before they've read any other book of the Bible. And if you do that, you're not going to be able to make any sense of it. Because they use a lot of the symbolism that you find in other prophets, and they sometimes combine them in new ways because they're trying to make a point. For example, the beast in the book of Revelation is a combination of the four beasts that the prophet Daniel talks about, which were four successive empires, which were the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, and then the Romans. But the beast in Revelation is a combination of all of them, which is one way of sort of saying that it's worse than all of them. It's all of them rolled into one. If you're not familiar with Daniel, you're not going to get any of that. It just sounds like, why is this a lion's head with bare feet and leopard skin and whatever it all has together, 10 horns. If you don't understand the rest of Scripture, you can't possibly make any sense of that. Any other questions? Okay.
Just a quick follow up.
Right. Yeah, if you go to the website and go to the articles section, I believe that it's listed there. But there's an article that says a guide to biblical reference material, and on that article, at the end of it, it's got a link to this blog post. But I think I might have that blog post link there as well. But it's a blog post that talks about free stuff on the internet, electronic biblical aids. And there's a ton of stuff that you can download for free, and eSword is one of the best things you can get, because I have a pretty good biblical reference library, and it mimics a lot of what I have, and a lot of it, it's so handy that I don't get some of these books off the shelf most of the time, because it's just easier to use what's on eSword. Although, having some of those references, I can get to what I want quicker, because they refer to the page number of some of the reference material that I have. So it makes it a lot easier for me to get to it. If you can't find it, let me know and I'll email it to you. Okay, all right. Thank you very much.